Hello and welcome to the History with Jackson podcast. Today on the History with Jackson podcast, we are speaking to author and historian Luke Daly. Luke is the host of the Daily Medieval podcast and the author of Medieval Latin, A Beginner's Self-Taught Guide. And today, Luke is talking to us about the commercialization of saints in the medieval period. Luke, how are you doing?
Yeah, I'm doing awesome. It's good to be here, man. Thank you for having me. I'm looking forward to this, yeah.
Yeah, no worries. I'm absolutely buzzing to talk about this topic because it's such an interesting topic. It's such a niche area as well. It's something that we don't often look at as historians. So I'm really excited to get into this with you. Now, firstly, Luke, can you tell us what a saint is and how one becomes a saint?
Yeah, I mean, so a saint in a way is kind of, you can almost say it's the Christian celebrity of the medieval era. It kind of is essentially a religious role model in the eyes of Christianity and a vessel for God. So there's kind of two pathways to becoming a saint. You kind of can be, you live as an aspirational model of what Christianity is or should be. And on your death, because you were such kind of a devotional figure, then you can be venerated. The other way is, of course, is being a martyr. So you die trying to protect your faith, trying to protect or defend Christianity, which is kind of a very common way, actually, that many people became saints, especially in like the later medieval period. But sainthood could only really be achieved once you died. And there's kind of two main steps once you died in becoming a saint. First was veneration, and then it's canonization. And not every saint actually achieved canonization, which is quite interesting because basically sanctity was authorized by the local bishop and the tomb was venerated. And then basically once miracles and kind of a life of the saint was kind of constructed and everything, it would be then put forward to the Pope for authorization, which could be refused or could be approved. If it was approved, you would then, as a saint, gain a recognized feast day and your cult would be verified and there would be an encouragement to promote the saint. But not many people, not all saints gained that kind of canonization, but a lot of them did get veneration. Yeah.
That's a great way of looking at how people became saints and the detailed structure that you have to go through in order to promote someone into that kind of position. But the way you talk about the different ways you become a saint, you kind of allude to that there's different types of people who become saints. So what types of people become saints?
I mean, in a sense, anyone could, in effect, become a saint. But typically, it was holy people, bishops, archbishops, popes. And then in terms of kind of the lay community, it was kings and knights, typically. It's very rare, apart from on the occasion, I guess, of William of Norwich, that someone of a very low class would become a saint. So it's typically those kind of higher authorities that could become saints, yeah.
Okay. And it's interesting, especially here in the East Midlands, you know, we still kind of have imagery of Saint Edmund, and a lot of English imagery of Saint Edward the Confessor. So I can kind of see that path you're going down with the martyrs and the kings because of what they did in their life.
Yeah.
Now, there's quite a lot of saints in the Catholic Church and essentially every single day is dedicated to one of them. But how important are these saints to everyday religious life in the medieval period?
So, I mean, they're incredibly important. I mean, like how I said earlier about the saints kind of are a vessel for God, it kind of provided an outlet to practice faith and to pray to, because it was almost in a kind of a kind of in terms of praying, it was almost unattainable to ask God of something. But by asking the saint was kind of almost like, you know, if you worked for Facebook, you couldn't email Mark Zuckerberg, but you could email your line manager. That kind of breaking down the distance between you and kind of what you want to attain. And so, you know, thousands of pilgrims would walk these pilgrimage routes going to these cathedrals because it was a way that they could practice their faith. It was an outlet that they could devote donations and practices to, and it gave people hope, really. And I think especially in, you know, as you kind of get on to the 14th century with the Black Death, it definitely gave people hope.
And perhaps why we've seen an increase in religiosity at this very moment as well. In 1066, there's a massive watershed moment in English history at the Norman Conquest. Now, obviously, the Normans have a very different approach to life due to their more medieval French influence into their lifestyle, as opposed to the more Scandinavian influence in the English lifestyle. Now, how did the Norman Conquest affect Britain's relationship with saints and religion?
Yes, I mean, there was a really big impact, actually, with this kind of imposition of Norman culture and kind of the way that they do things on the continent. What you see is actually a lot of these monastic communities trying to really legitimize their saints in this new world. You see new practices emerging. One of the main things is the production of hagiographies, which is the life and miracles of the saint. And also you see translation ceremonies where, again, these are all things that come from the continent that weren't previously seen in, you know, Anglo-Saxon England. But the reason why these monastic communities are doing them is so then they kind of fit into this kind of Christian culture that you see in France and you know, Italy and all these other places. And you also see as well, quite interestingly, a real boom in bishops predominantly becoming saints, which you don't quite see beforehand. Obviously, you know, St. Edmund, for example, is a king, and there are quite a lot of different kings and rulers that become saints in the Anglo-Saxon period. But afterwards, you then get people such as Thomas Becket, who, of course, is a bishop, emerging as saints as well. And you don't see as much kings becoming saints. So there is a definite shift between these periods marked by the Norman Conquest.
And it's interesting you say that the rise of bishops as well, not always considered the most important position within the church, but certainly rising in prominence and definitely with the Norman influence. It's quite nice to see that change happening. Now, you've mentioned monasteries and you've mentioned saints and bishops and translation ceremonies, but how important were these saints to abbeys and monasteries throughout this period?
I think one thing that is quite interesting that's seen in sources is about this kind of territorial influence and kind of monasteries and abbeys trying to spread their sphere of influence over pilgrims to kind of, in order to gain wealth, but also patronage, art, culture, and faith. So saints were kind of a really strong way that they would be able to compete with bigger monastic communities, especially on the continent, such as Cluny or the Abbey of Saint Denis in Paris. So they were definitely, by especially marketing their saint to people on the continent, it helped bring in this kind of art and culture that is kind of unattainable otherwise, in a sense. So they were pretty key in running of kind of that idea of status, really.
And it's quite nice to see that not only is trade one of these ideas where ideas, culture, is exchanged, but actually pilgrimage is commercialization and almost a holiday, really, is another example of this cultural exchange across Europe, which is so important and clear to see for quite a lot of people for the medieval period. Now, you've touched on spheres of influence and marketing, which are not traditionally ideas we associate with the church. How did the church start to commercialize these saints? You've touched on it ever so slightly. And where is this money coming from?
I mean, essentially, it comes from donations from pilgrims. The whole aim, in a sense, of marketing these saints is to bring in pilgrims and by extension, bring in their money. We see from sources such as William of Malmesbury that saints that promoted a culture that you were expected to donate a degree of your finances to the local shrine. We see in the Miracula of St. Erkenwald in London, a demand that you should come to the shrine and that you must donate your money. And so that's kind of where it is, really. In a kind of odd sense, it's not marketed for massive payments from, say, kings or nobles, but it's about taking the money from the everyday person, in a sense, which I guess may sound malicious. Whether it was or not is a difficult thing to distinguish, but it was the coin from the everyday person.
And it's interesting to see how the everyday person is the target, much as it is today, with how, as you said, modern day celebrities, medieval celebrities being the saints, how they're still targeting the same people and they're working and marketing around the same people. And much as modern day people tend to flip-flop around which celebrities they worship and they support, I'm trying to take a quick guess that were these medieval people consistently changing which saints they were supporting or worshipping at this time, or did they have a saint and just stick with that saint?
Yeah, I mean, it comes back to that idea of the whole territorial influence. I can't remember who it was now, but there was a source from basically somewhere in the west of England that was kind of a bit jealous of all the pilgrims going to St. Edmund in the east. And so they sought to promote their cult in order to bring some of those pilgrims back. And so, yeah, I mean, in the way that we have trends nowadays and people switch between the newest trend, when you had a saint pop up that was doing all these miracles, people would go and focus their faith to them because that was the newest thing. It was almost as if the miracles of saint could eventually run out almost, so that you would switch in between them. I mean, for some people who are in the local area, of course, you might stick to one saint for your whole life. But in a kind of wider picture, there was this kind of battle, territorial battle between monastic communities over pilgrims, because people would switch between them.
And given that it's a peaceful religion on a whole, the message being given is a peaceful message, it's quite interesting to see that there's a lot of infighting within the church. There's political battles creating these cults and trying to lure these people into their cults and following these saints. Now, once the medieval people, the everyday man, has been lured into this cult and worshipping the saint, how do they go about worshipping these saints and being involved in these cults?
Yeah, so essentially a cathedral would have a section where the shrine is, and people would be encouraged to proceed around it and pray and donate. But then obviously, something brought in post-conquest era is this kind of idea of ceremonies and feast days, such as the translation, which obviously you see big influxes of pilgrims when these ceremonies happen. So those are kind of the two biggest ways, really. You have the everyday prayer and donation, but also then these big events that are coming.
And these big events within your paper, you you really build the occasion up, and you talk about the majesty. But the one thing that sticks out to me quite clearly within your paper is the idea of candles. You speak about thousands of candles and candles within God knows how many ceremonies. How are candles such an important part of worshiping saints? And as a personal interest question, typically how much wax was used for these ceremonies?
Yeah. I mean, it's an incredible amount. And wax is quite expensive for the volume that they were using. You see when Henry II and a few other kings go through these kind of cathedral areas and they visit these shrines, they donate large amounts of waxes, you know, half a ton's worth of wax in a way. And what you see as well in the finances is how much this kind of wax costs. Norwich, for instance, had kind of an annual budget for the whole year of £50 to maintain their shrine. Now, £30 of that was used just to buy wax. And this was used to buy essentially, yeah, about half a ton of wax. And this would just be used for altars and donations and for pilgrims to buy and light a candle in the same way that kind of we do nowadays when people go to a church or a cathedral and they light a candle and make a prayer. This kind of wax enterprise had to fuel this. And especially if you're having ceremonies such as translation ceremonies where hundreds, even thousands of pilgrims are coming, you need to have a lot of wax to sustain that. Which is why then it's interesting when you look in the miracles of St. William, how every single miracle involves this idea of donating wax to kind of help supplement that that cost.
And as a personal interest, it's never been an industry which I even thought about linking to the church or saints. And it's so interesting to see that there's this massive industry that's sprung up and churches are dedicating large chunks of their finances towards having to sustain the wax stores that they need for these ceremonies. Now, we've looked at where the money's coming from and we're looking at where the money's going, but how much money did these churches and these cults need to sustain themselves?
So this is very difficult because of the kind of finance accounts to pinpoint an exact figure, but from what the kind of finances show, to sustain a cult you have to sustain the shrine itself, obviously, so the tomb and kind of the surrounding shrine. So to maintain the shrine, typically you would employ a shrine keeper. Now, there's evidence of two shrine keepers at Canterbury. Each were paid one penny a day. On top of that, wax, of course, this massive cost, would cost the cathedral 5 to 7 pennies per pound. So if you're getting half a ton, as we see at Norwich, that costs you £30. Then, of course, you have the building projects to build the shrine itself, to maintain the shrine. This could be, you know, £100 as well. And so it's difficult to express an exact number, but it was really expensive in a way. And this is one thing that I looked at in the paper, was kind of, was it really a viable cost? Because there's a hell of a lot of an input here to get it up running and to get it going. And, you know, this doesn't take into consideration all the other potential people who help in running the shrine and its cult and all the different, I mean, the costs for doing a translation ceremony, and especially if you made it big, it's really expensive, to say the least.
So did these cults provide a stable income for churches, and how much of a burden was it on some of these places?
So I guess the conclusion that I make is that it's not really... It's kind of a temporary gain rather than a consistent income. You had to make quite a high investment. Now, when we look at Canterbury with Thomas Becket, they yielded an incredible amount of wealth. So actually, it did account for quite a lot of the church income, because you had thousands of pilgrims coming to visit, each of them donating. You had kings and royals coming because he was such a prominent figure. However, when you look at Norwich, it was a complete failure. They never really took off. They did a series of translation ceremonies to try and gain people, but it never really, you know, it never really emerged into anything. And so for them, it was more expensive, really. So as such, it kind of, Saints really just provided a temporary, it was a temporary hustle rather than a permanent and stable income. But it was, it aided in helping that prominence and status of them long term, I guess.
Oh, fantastic. And I really like the temporary hustle kind of yeah. phrasing of that. It kind of makes it seem that, you know, these churches can't sustain the income from the saints. Now, I wanted to touch on actually the seeing how churches were able to maintain the relevance of their cult, to maintain the relevance of their saint. Because obviously, as you've just touched, it's not a stable income. So at some point, the relevance of the saint must be decreasing and people's interest in that saint must be decreasing. But what did churches do to combat that?
Yeah, I mean, this is where hagiographies play quite a key role in way, because as a part of, to go alongside the saint, you would produce a hagiography, which could be split up into three main sections: the life of the person, the discovery of their relics, and then a collection of their miracles. So this was kind of a physical thing that was attributed to this person as to why they're worthwhile in a way. And what you see is that in different administrations that come in, they edit and adapt the hagiography to kind of renew it, to add more miracles to it, to change different aspects, to kind of keep that life of the person going and the memory going. You also then have, then obviously the ceremony. So you have a translation ceremony, you might have multiple over time if, for some reason. Sometimes they will translate the body to a new area if they're doing building projects. So that's a whole ceremony. And then what you see actually with Thomas Becket is a kind of anniversary ceremony as well. 10 years after he died, 50 years after he was translated, you know, so forth, to try and reinvigorate those pilgrims. Because what we see from the donation finances is that after these ceremonies, which kind of give you a peak, there is a steady decline of pilgrims afterwards. And so it really does take quite a lot of effort to maintain relevance, really, especially if new saints are popping up around you. So you really have to double down on it.
And it's interesting that they're using all their own skills, you know, the writing, the transcribing, to try and maintain the cult around their saints. And you touch on Thomas Becket. I think Thomas Becket is an absolutely fascinating character and a really interesting part of English history. But what we often don't talk about with Thomas Becket, we tend to get bogged down in his murder and his relationship with King Henry. How does Thomas Becket's cult emerge? And how was it just one place that made money off this cult, or was it a more widespread kind of cult where various different parties were profiting off him?
Well, Becket is an interesting case, because it's almost one of the reasons why I undertook this topic, because what you see with Becket, so usually when you look at, say, St. Edmund or any of the other saints, they don't really become saints. Some take decades till they get that kind of veneration and that cult emerge. Whereas Becket is extremely quick. So I mean, he is one of the most recognizable and famous people in medieval history. And so he has obviously this confrontation, this heated issue with Henry II, gets killed, and then essentially within 3 years, there are two hagiographies written about him, and an invitation to the Pope to venerate and canonize him. And what we actually see is a really interesting letter from the Pope writing to Canterbury to say, take more time to find more miracles and witnesses before asking for official veneration. You're doing this way too quickly, and it's almost a bit strange. Now, what's interesting is that the community of Canterbury is actually soon put under threat by an attack because of this kind of political rawness. They're trying to kind of make money off of the saint. They're trying to get him out there, get people coming, and it's almost too quick. People are still, you know, grieving over it and still seeing what's the kind of short-term repercussions are, and they're getting straight into it with everything. But what is interesting is that they are successful. And what you see is other churches and sites, particularly around Kent, who claim connection to Becket. Now, a good example actually is Carlisle Cathedral. And as soon as the saint died, they quickly claimed to hold the sword that martyred Becket. But then what you see as well, which is quite interesting, is then with the establishment of Becket's cult, monastic communities with major saints were also keen to protect their own saints. So you have Reading Abbey, for example, which reaffirmed and emphasized visions of Saint James the Great, who informed the sick that they could only be cured at Reading, nowhere else. So you see places popping up that are seeking to make money off of Becket, and then you see places that are kind of trying to really protect themselves from this new saint because of how popular he is, because of the so many pilgrims visiting literally straight after his death.
And it's a sad case, really, to see a whole country grieving, but people and the church manipulating that cause for their own benefit, really. And you see that, you know, as you just said, with Carlisle and with Reading Abbey as well. And it's really interesting to see those dynamics playing out. Now, our second saint that you mentioned in your paper, and I really do recommend your paper to everyone, is a saint which I feel a particular affinity to here in the east of England, and it's Saint Edmund. Now, you've touched on him just briefly when we were talking about Thomas Becket. Now, how did Saint Edmund cult arise, and how did certain places try and commercialize Saint Edmund?
Well, Saint Edmund's an interesting case as well, because unlike Becket, he is a pre-conquest saint. So he was a 9th century king of East Anglia, and the story goes that you have the great heathen army invade East Anglia. Any Vikings fans out there will know about that. And basically, Edmund, in order to defend Christianity in England, sought to defeat them and push them back. He was, however, captured and defeated. He was tied to a tree, shot with multiple arrows, and beheaded. And his head was stolen, apparently, by a wolf. So the group of monks basically seek out his body. And this is kind of where this miraculous event occurs, because one thing you should know about saints is that their body is perfectly preserved. It doesn't decompose. So they find his body perfectly intact, and they find the wolf with the head. The wolf willingly gives it back, and the head reattaches with this body. And so they're like, wow, this is awesome. So the cult then kind of develops around that story. And it's still, I mean, if you go to bury St. Edmund's now, there's this kind of whole idea about the wolf and everything is still so prominent now. But what is really particularly amazing about this cult, and what is my favorite thing about it, is that it's kind of their exploitation is so blatant. Edmund was translated in 1095, which, unlike Becket, that was kind of venerated and translated within 4 months. Obviously, this is, you know, a couple of centuries after. And his accompanying miracle was produced and written by a guy called Archdeacon Herman. Now, Herman and Abbot Baldwin is kind of then what we see about this mass marketing commercialization, almost commercializing and marketing a product how you would nowadays. And basically, Herman himself is, after he dies, is accused of simony, which is the accusation of making money off of relics, because he would invite people to come and walk around the saint's tomb, but also to pay a little bit extra to be able to touch the relics, because obviously it was believed that these relics had holy power. So there's a story that's written about Herman, where a noble comes to St. Edmund and wants to basically have a look at the shrine, and Herman, with everyone eagerly awaiting, brings out this blooded cloth that has arrow holes in it, and it's blooded and everything. And as he's kind of doing it all and doing his thing, he basically falls ill and dies within 3 days. And it's that kind of story that it's kind of written about by some monks as kind of a bit of a, you know, you shouldn't be doing this type thing. So it's really interesting that there's kind of this blatant mass marketing of Edmund by Abbot Baldwin and Archdeacon Herman.
But it's a super clever manipulation of the cult of church history to benefit Bury St. Edmund. So, you know, it's a competitive landscape. English monastic and bishopric orders. Now, you touch on nobility coming to see relics and coming to see saints. The English kings have a particular affinity for certain saints and venerated individuals. We see that with Edward's love of Saint Edward the Confessor. But how involved were kings in these two cults or other cults?
Yeah, I mean, what's interesting is that actually royalty kind of plays a minor role in terms of saint cults. I mean, you see, it's very typical, obviously, as kings travel around England that they visit and they donate to shrines. And we see evidence of that with various kings donating wax and money and jewels and all sorts. But they don't really interact much. And what we actually see quite a funny story in the Miracula of St. Cuthbert is actually that some kings even feared saints, because after the conquest, when William the Conqueror took over England, he came into conflict with Durham and the North. And Durham, of course, is the site of St. Cuthbert, which was regarded as the saint of the North. And essentially, in the hagiography, Cuthbert protects the monastic community through a series of miracles, one of which is inflicting pain and illness onto King William, who was kind of attesting that Cuthbert was a fake and that, you know, there's no reason that to afford them the privileges that they're asking. And it actually, this kind of experience kind of freaks him out a bit and actually makes him fear Durham and fear St. Cuthbert. And he actually gives them the privileges that they asked for and cancels the attacks that he was going to set on them. So it's kind of interesting in that kind of sense that you know, especially in a world today that has the kind of, I guess, primarily atheists, that, you know, the idea that you would really fear such a character is quite interesting.
And it's particularly interesting with William's harrying of the North, and that's been claimed as a form of genocide, that he would even spare a place like Durham from this attack due to the power of saints. It's an incredibly powerful thing to hear about. Now, it links the idea of faith in a wider context, and the cults and saints in a wider context. So how do these saints and these cults around the saints link to faith in a wider context, the 11th to the 13th century?
Well, this period, many scholars will attribute as being the golden age of monasticism, really. And there is just this powerful energy, in a way, throughout Europe within Christianity that is leading to the production of such incredible works of art, philosophy, literature, theology, as well as building projects, all aided by patronage and by the finances of shrine donations. We see, for instance, in Hereford, massive building works being commissioned because of these shrine donations and because of the cults that are funding them. So it's kind of, in a way, the foundation of this kind of glowing age is kind of this donation to by pilgrims to saints. So it is really important in that sense.
And I love your term around the golden age. I think it's an incredibly beautiful term to define this era and define Europe's and England's relationship with saints, certainly post-conquest. Now, when you have a golden age, things must end. You often end up with a gilded age or a silver age. So how did these cults die? How did these cults end?
Yeah, well, as you say, when things go up, they must come down. And basically, what's really unfortunate is that on one hand, some of them just go out of fashion, like with William of Norwich. You kind of, what you see is this real dispute over if he's actually real, and if it is something that needs to be canonized, and eventually that's disproved and everything. And so it just goes out of fashion. But what's kind of really, I guess, unfortunate in a way is the dissolution of the monasteries by Henry VIII and kind of then the Reformation that really just clamped down and get rid of this whole idea of cults and not necessarily idol worship, but that kind of worshipping someone rather than God himself or Jesus. So they just kind of diminish and disappear by the early modern period, which is a shame in a sense. But we see, for instance, with St. Edmund, is that he is taken to potentially France when the dissolution of the monasteries is happening. So there is a real fear at that time for saints.
And that whole removal or change in religion by Henry VIII is an incredibly important event, not just in English history, in European history. It really changes the landscape of religion across this whole period. And Henry VIII's impact is not something to turn your nose up at, really. But as someone from Peterborough, I'm distinctly aware of the effect of Henry VIII, certainly because of our cathedral and our cathedral history. Now, your paper is primarily based upon primary sources, and I love a good paper with a huge amount of primary sources. It shows a huge amount of research and dedication to your craft. And one of these pieces of primary sources that stuck out to me about the commercialization of saints was Benedict's or Peterborough's source. I can't quite remember off the top of my head what it was, but as a scholar of Latin, an expert in the Latin language, how important was your knowledge of Latin in being able to read the work of Benedict of Peterborough?
Yeah, so Benedict of Peterborough, actually, he was one of the ones who wrote the Miracula of Thomas Becket, actually. So he's quite a very important person in that respect. But what you see in all these hagiographies, in the Miracula, in all these texts, is basically Latin. Vernacular English, even Old English, wasn't really used until the 14th century. And so we're still in this world that's dominated by Latin and oral tradition. Miracles were collected based on word of mouth and pilgrims kind of reading about them. And so essentially, yeah, you kind of, to tackle these sources, there are thankfully a lot of A lot of them have since been translated by historians, but there's still a wide range of them that haven't. And so by knowing a degree of Latin, it does help you tackle those sources that you otherwise wouldn't be able to. And with such a paper, it's really kind of prominently relying on those sources, it would be very difficult otherwise to write about.
And I suppose your immense knowledge of Latin is really helping with your path through these primary sources, because sometimes the Vatican is not the most forthcoming with translations for these documents. Mm. Now, a final fun question for you, Luke. As a keen medievalist, I'd like to ask you, which three people from the medieval period would you like to have dinner with?
Well, so firstly, I would say my main one, I think, would be someone called Abbot Suger of St. Denis. He led a life dominated by encouraging art and culture. He was known to be one of the most wonderful storytellers. But basically, he had a really important role in constructing the image of Capetian kingship. He had a really close relationship with King Louis, who was reigning at the time, this the 12th century. And basically, as well, what we see is that him using Capetian kingship to also bolster the status of himself and the abbey at Paris. And so he really is a hugely fascinating person. The next one has got to be Archdeacon Herman for his scandalous exploits, just because it'd be really interesting to kind of learn more about that kind of side of things, to see if it was, I guess, the extent to which it was really a conscious effort. And then the last one, I think, that would be really interesting is got to be the renowned Venetian merchant Marco Polo, because he was the most traveled man in history up until that point. And to be able to see all these rich cultures that kind of, I guess, in history we learn about individually, you know, he'll kind of bring that all together. And I think that's really interesting.
I think that is a really, really fascinating dinner time conversation that you'd have. Definitely. And certainly never a combination you will never hear of again. I've certainly never heard of that combination before. So I will hold my hands up to that and say that's probably one of the best combinations I've ever heard. Now, Luke, if people want to learn more about this topic, where can they go?
So there is, obviously you can read my paper, but if you want, there are three really good kind of secondary sources done by three fabulous historians. The first one, the main one, is Benjamin Nielsen's book called Cathedral Shrines of England. That gives a whole vast array of finances and donation culture, and it's really kind of the basis in a way for all this kind of looking at shrines. Another one is John Crookes, looking at English medieval shrines, kind of similar to Nielsen in that kind of respect. And then the last one I would highly recommend is Ronald Finucane's one, which is Miracles and Pilgrims, Popular Beliefs in Medieval England, that kind of looking at pilgrim culture, miracles, belief systems. So a combination of those three, I think you'd be sufficiently well-equipped, I'd say.
Awesome. And I'll make sure the titles of those books are in the description for our watchers and listeners. And if they want to go and find your paper, Luke, where can they find that?
You can actually find it. You can find it on my website I've got, which is www.medievallatin.com. It's under the articles section. So you can find it there.
And interestingly, your website's called Medieval Latin. Now, you've recently published a book, Luke, which is absolutely awesome, and it is a fantastic book. And I've learned a lot by just looking through it, and even been able to look at some translations myself a little bit with your book. So would you mind telling us about your book and telling our listeners where they can find it?
Thank you. Well, essentially, sadly, with education, Latin is now rarely taught at schools and even universities. The university that I'm at, I think they've kind of, for their second year undergraduates, they've kind of got rid of it now, which is a shame. So, but it is such a crucial tool for medieval history, and it's so crucial that people learn it to be able to access this wide range of material. So the book aims at basically introducing, for complete beginners, introducing medieval Latin through the use of charters, because any historian will tell you how useful charters are, and that they're the foundation of medieval history in a way. So basically, equip people with those tools to tackle primary sources. So you can find it on Amazon, basically if you type in medieval Latin beginner self-taught guide, and you can also find a link to it via my website as well as some chapters from it that give you an example of what to kind of look for.
It really is a truly fantastic book. I'd really recommend it to everyone. I will make sure the link to Luke's book is in the description below, so you guys can go and have a look for it yourself. Now, thank you very much, Luke, for coming on the podcast. I really appreciate it. And
thank you for having me.
Oh, no worries. No worries at all. I've learned so much from you. It's such a fascinating topic, and I hope our listeners and people watching have learned just as much as I have. Now, guys, if you have enjoyed this podcast, please make sure you leave a review, a like, or a comment. It really helps History of Jackson grow and to reach new people. So thank you very much for listening to this episode of the History of Jackson podcast, guys, and I'll see you next episode.